Shalom, everybody, and welcome to the Yishai Fleischer Show, broadcasting live from Jerusalem to the world. You're a part of it wherever you are. And shalom, and welcome to the Western Wall. There's like a series of tunnels next to the Western Wall Plaza, and I'm in one. And I'm not here by myself. I'm here with Rabbi Mike Foyer. Rabbi Mike, shalom and welcome.
Shalom, Yishai. I love the new pad.
Yes, I've wanted to do a show here forever. And we're like, we are just steps away from the Western Wall, not the holiest place for the Jewish people, but certainly close to it. The outer, one of the four remaining walls of the temple, which they are all extant. The outer.
Of the supporting structure.
Supporting structure of the temple, correct. The sandbox that so made the Temple Mount much bigger acreage area on top there. But we are, in any case, forget it. Don't worry about the small things right now. We're here in Jerusalem on the Land of Israel Network, on the Yishai Fleischer Show, and Rabbi Mike Foyer. You may not know this. It happens to be my birthday.
What? I didn't
That's
know.
Right.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. Thank you.
Oh, we're going to hear some blessings before the day is through.
Well, I bless us to have a good show.
Oh, man. I'm not going to let you get away with that.
But that's actually why I'm at the Kotel today.
Ah, it's all coming clear to me
yeah,
now.
Yeah, I was just like, I dive in here, and then I met one other person. I met a great guy named Michael Block from McKenzie. And he took me out for some coffee, and we met, and then I'm meeting you, and then I'm meeting another. I'm actually meeting somebody from the U.S. Embassy to talk about the UNESCO problem that Hebron is having now.
But not down here, because apparently this isn't in our country.
Right, I didn't even ask. I said, meet me at Mamilla. By the way, speaking of Hebron, I want to do a shout-out to our beloved Director General of the Hebron Jewish Community, Uri Karzin, and
God
a lover of the show, and he sends his regards to you.
Most kindly accepted, and you should have a holy Shabbos.
Amen. And right now, also, Hebron is fighting for its identity in global politics, since the good folks at UNESCO, who are in charge of trying to protect heritage sites, have become the greatest enemies.
A tool of identity theft.
Right, a tool of identity theft. Certainly tools. There are a bunch of tools over there of identity theft. And they are now set to tell the world that Hebron is a city in danger and that Marat HaMachpelah, the Tomb of the Fathers and Mothers, is a Palestinian heritage site called the Ibrahimi Mosque. And we're basically, we're
gearing up for battle.
We're gearing up for battle, but like this thing of identity theft, it's bewildering. You know, when you're your own identity and somebody's coming to steal away your identity, and they're managing to somehow do it, you're just like, it's bewildering.
I think this is one of the great struggles that Am Yisrael has fought down through time. We don't need to drag through 3,000 years of history, but it's not the first time in our history where another people came along and claimed to be us. And through an insufficiency of their own identity, actually had the need to claim our own.
When are you referring to specifically?
The biggest and perhaps first recorded case of identity theft in history was, of course, early Christianity declaring itself to be the new Israel.
Right.
Right.
Early Christianity, basically, that's replacement theology.
Yes.
And it's not even theology. It's also replacement tactics. I mean, see, part of it is theology and part of it is this like...
Well, then there's the practical expression, which is if you're the new Israel, then the old Israel certainly has to go in the same way that today...
And if it hasn't gone, then the only reason it's around is to show how pathetic it is.
Well, that was, by the 4th century when we showed a staying power, which was unexpected, there had to be sort of a certain theological shift, as was true, by the way, in 1964 when the Catholic Church had to rework its theology to accept the fact that Am Yisrael was back in its land and was existent and that the world wasn't going to work by trying to wipe us out anymore.
Right.
And we're kind of waiting for that sea shift on the part of the Arab world, to accept the fact that we exist
right.
and that we've come back to our land. And then we'll work out how to make a new mode of living. But until
what
it happens...
we see the opposite. We see a doubling down right now with the help of the old folks out there in Europe who have practiced at this.
That's kind of what I meant when I said that this is an old story.
Right.
It's deep, I think, in the sort of cultural DNA of Europe to need to deny the existence of the Jews as an entity and certainly as a nation.
Sometimes you're just like, Europe, get over yourself. Like modernized, like welcome, hello.
I don't think you appreciate the depth of the struggle of what it is to change your identity. Remember, European identity, as much as they don't like to tell a story as such, right, came into existence together with the Jews. Right? Christianity was born in its struggle with the Jews, and therefore, for us to maintain our integrity over the long run really forces them to reevaluate who they are. And most people are not willing to do that. Faced with
But they are reevaluating in the sense that they've lost their religion. These are not religious people anymore. They've lost a sense of nationality. They've lost a sense of family. You would think that in a, that one thing they would also give up in all this is their deep anti-Semitism, right? You would think that they'd be like, why would we care about this anymore since we don't care about anything else? Yet they've managed to, like, get rid of their own French German identity and all that. They're not in their churches. You would think they would drop anti-Semitism. No, the one thing that they have held on to strong is this.
Yeah, I bless you someday to have teenage children, to be healthy and well, and you'll understand that actually the simplest, most powerful and most profound element of identity is not the positive element. That's in the long run, that's maturity, that's acquiring a sense of who I am. But who I'm not is a deeply visceral and foundational move. And I think that what you're identifying is that much of Europe has lost its sense of positive identity, and yet they have not given up on the sense of who they are not. There's a rejectionist stance. We see it here. You know, I mean, really, like, I don't necessarily want to slide into it right now, but if you just see recently someone published a book of Palestinian history that was mostly empty pages.
Yes.
Right? I mean, it's a joke, but it's not. Right, because the essence of specifically Palestinian national identity was born out of the rejection of the return to our land. So what do you have if you reject? Nothing. And that's a scary prospect for people.
But you know, the way you said it, that it was born out of it, I would say it's not even born out of a struggle. It was actually just a tactic of the struggle.
Yes. And then it metamorphosed.
I got to tell you, recently, Rabbi Jonathan Sacks released a video in which he was like, BDS is really anti-Semitism.
Right, and he says it with that accent, too.
Right, but then he's like, although I believe in a right of a Palestinians to have their own state, BDS is anti-Semitism. And I'm like, you said, this is Treif, but the big one, you made kosher. The big faith. BDS is nothing but a newer tactical of the bigger tactic against Israel, which is Palestinianism, and you just did what Saul did. You got rid of some of the Amalekites, but Agag you left alive.
Yeah.
You didn't slay the big one. Okay, the big one. You not only did you not slay him, you actually like gave him nice food and said, and you actually koshered it. You, a rabbi, have no right to in my opinion, you have no. I mean, right or no, forget the right language. You should not kosher the big tool against us.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're deep into politics, so why not go all the way? Listen, I have no problem with Palestinians have a state. I just don't want them to take ours. Meaning, if you want to say that a people has a right to a state, we can have a theoretical discussion about what that means, have a right to a state.
But they don't mean
but
that.
I know they don't mean
people,
that, and that's my problem.
They're not a people without their conflict, like you just said. They don't want a state. That's all a joke. They want this land. They want to get rid of us.
I understand that, which is why I feel like falling into that trap is a deep mistake. We need to really get to the core of this, which is that, okay, who are you? Don't tell me what you want. Don't tell me about your rights. Tell me who you are. And therefore, what you're going to be in the world. I mean, right now, I can't imagine what it would be to empower the elements of Palestinian society that are truly striving for nationalism. Okay, maybe here and there are some sparks of a more enlightened embracing of the world as a whole, right? But by and large, you're talking about empowering the most vicious elements of the society around us and giving them territorial and military integrity. It's like a bad joke.
Do you remember that? There was once a South Park about Mormonism, and it kept on being like, dumb, 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 dumb. It's like there are so many dumbs at this crossroads. Okay, it's like it's not smart militarily and smart in our identity, and so many other ways. It's so easy to prove what we're facing, and yet I got to tell you, I face these young liberal Jewish groups. And it's as though I got there too late.
You know, I can make a segue out of this right to our parsha and watch me do it.
I was going
to
do that also.
All right, I get the first shot.
Go ahead.
Right? This is one of the most important rules of understanding human behavior, which is face with the impossible and the unacceptable, people will always choose the impossible. Because the impossible, well, you know, it could work, it could work, it could work. Don't be a naysayer, don't be so, et cetera. But the unacceptable means I have to completely reevaluate the way I understand the world. So here in this sense is that there is sort of like a belief in the sort of economic and cultural feasibility of if all people are the same and peace and jihad is just misunderstood and all these things. And that's ridiculous. But to reevaluate that for the world means to completely reevaluate the understand human behavior.
Okay, but tie it into the parsha.
So in the same way, Korach, when he starts his rebellion, I mean, at what point did he think that 10 plagues, the splitting of the Red Sea, standing at Sinai, weren't indicative that God was actually in charge?
Right.
But he didn't want to accept that because that meant he wasn't going to get what he wanted personally. So therefore, he decided to just push the impossible. No, really, it's actually all Moshe. It's really all Moshe, but really, what was it? It was all him. And in the same way, I suspect that's a lot of what's driving the forces against us as well. Ideology aside, there's a huge amount of personal status and energy invested in the idea of the two-state solution.
Right, absolutely. And when you go to visit offices like the foreign ministry or something, you see that there's a lot of clerks and bureaucrats that are there, and they have their opinion. You're not going to get them out, and they have a lot invested. Or professors, if you go to the universities, there's definitely that as well. I was actually going to take a different tack to tie it into the Torah portion, and we are talking about the Torah portion of Korach. It's in the book of Numbers, in the desert, the fourth book of the Pentateuch. And
you said that so well.
Yeah, and it's as you alluded, it's a rebellion against Moses. This is one of the more political Torah portions, as was the last one. And we were talking about identity theft. The accusation against Moses is that he is wielding power over people and suppressing them in order to hoard power to himself instead of sharing it with the people. Yet the Torah told us only two Torah portions ago, this is the most humble man on the face of the earth, one who, when he hears another prophet say, you're going to die and not go into the land of Israel, he says, I wish everybody was a prophet. That would be great. I'm not trying to. And God says, how about you share some of your prophetic energy with the 70 other elders? He's like, let's do it. And he's in no way trying to hoard power to himself. And here comes this accusation, which is very much like an accusation that says, Hebron, that's not Jewish. It's like, wait a minute. What do you mean? That's absurd. It's
you
the
don't
very
get more Jewish.
Right.
Than that.
It's the most Jewish. This is the beating heart of Judaism, the cradle of our civilization, and yet the accusation is exactly the opposite. So it's like a whole olam hafuch. It's an upside down world. The upside down world is this guy comes up to Moses, and you know it's very powerful. Hey, you're Mr. Big Tzaddik guy. The truth is, let me expose you. You're actually hoarding power. You're Mr. Magician Man. You got it all. You know, all the people are holy.
Well, yeah, the scale and absurdity of an accusation actually gives it weight. I mean, you know, the willingness to stand up to Moshe himself. Everybody else knows they split the Red Sea. You know, it means, oh, people say, wow, Korach wouldn't have said that if what happened weren't true. And I think actually the most important and the deepest part of this story is in the truth of what Korach says. Right, and as our sages teach us, that there is no such thing as a lie that exists in the world without some grain of truth. Right, and so here, what Korach says is right. He says, "Kol ha'ida kulam kedoshim ubutocham Hashem." Right, the whole community, the whole people is holy, and God is amongst them. So at that point, everybody's nodding and saying, "Is Moshe going to argue with that?" You know, at the same time, there's two pieces here. One is just a blatant lie in the sense that that's not his goal. He's looking for his self-elevation.
Right. As P.G. O'Rourke says, power to the people means power to me and some of my friends.
Right.
Okay?
For sure.
So that, you know, you get the sense, this guy's not real. It's tactical what he's saying.
Well, not only that, you also get the sense
it's
that even
the opposite.
If it's real,
it's about me.
Look what's happened to the people in the last, you know, several chapters. They're not ready to pick up that burden. At this point, it's going to take 40 more years before they're even ready to go into the land.
Right.
So the premature assertion that we're all holy, we don't need you, I find it very similar to a lot of the sort of very idealistic and misguided language that I see out in the world today about how, like, you know, we don't need governments, we don't need borders,
right.
We don't need, I mean, yes, please God, let Mashiach come, and there will be an evolution of consciousness, and we will all truly get along, and, you know, the whole world will stream to Har HaBayit to praise the Lord. But in the meantime, back here on planet, we know what's
planet
going
reality,
on.
Planet reality,
you know, like I'm not really willing to bare my throat in order to prove to you that we're not there yet.
Right.
And that's why Moshe takes.
But that comes a lot of times. What you just described comes from a naivete, a youth, a kind of unfamiliarity with realpolitik, with the real life. Korach is not that.
No, but he uses it.
Right.
He sweeps
right.
quite a number of people behind him.
Right. But it's very much because he is a very worldly person. He's, by the way, interestingly enough, considered one of the richest men, or the richest man. He was very, very, very wealthy. He had power.
Yes.
He had power.
And wisdom. Says that, what did he think he was going to actually accomplish here, right? And the Gemara says, Koch Pekehaya. Right? He was a sharp-eyed guy. What did he see in this foolishness? He even saw the future. Saw, in fact, that he was going to have a very famous descendant who in many ways would redeem his approach. You, of course, know who his famous descendant was, yes? Right? Samuel the prophet. At the same time, to look 1,000 years ahead.
Well, Samuel the prophet is, does he redeem his approach or does he redeem Moses' approach? Meaning to say...
Well, I mean, do we want to go there right now? I think in many ways he actually does redeem the Korach's approach because it's the end of the priesthood. It's not for naught that Shmuel is the one who actually announces the end of the rule of the priesthood over Am Yisrael. Mm-hmm. Right? Eli HaKohen, or Eli the priest,
right,
is really the last priest until Ezra that claims leadership. And Ezra studiously avoids claiming it as priest. He does it as scribe, you know, in the word of the Lord. And there's a lot you can pull out, particularly there's a lot of what's called intertextuality, a lot of textual parallels and interplay between the story of Koch and the story of Shmuel. But most importantly, from my point, is that it was in many ways Koch's wealth and wisdom that misled him. Because in opposition to Moshe, what he lacked was humility.
Right. And there are claims... The absurdity of the claim, you, Moses, are trying to abuse power. And then later, another claim, and notice the relationship here. Last Torah portion, we learned that the land of Israel is a land of milk and honey, but we won't be able to attain it. The slip in philosophy is now, hey, Moses, you took us out of a land of milk and honey. You took us, like back then, two parshas ago, we're like, oh, we missed those leeks and watermelons and onions that we were served in Egypt. Then it's like, well, land of Israel is a good land, but it's hard to get there. And then it's like, wait a minute, you took us out of a good land. You took us out of a land of milk and honey. You see what happens? That's a kind of ideological equivocation.
Inversion.
Inversion. It slips. It slides. By the way, I notice this a lot of times that people, I've said this a few times, people really change their philosophies around their realities.
Oh, yes. It's very hard not to.
Right. And a philosophy is actually a kind of program that you run in order to explain, understand, and run the life that you lead.
Yes.
You know? And so,
few people live otherwise.
Right. The other way of doing it is having a philosophy and living a life according to that. Here it's more like, let me justify and give license to my lifestyle.
By the way, I think that this is a psychological understanding of the teaching of our sages, that Avir de Eretz Yisrael machkim, right? That the air of Eretz Yisrael makes you wise. I mean, how many people have very good reasons and not justifications, but honest analyses of why it's impossible to make Aliyah, right? Why we're not, I can't make it there culturally, linguistically, financially, what have you. Real. I'm not talking about people making excuses. And yet they adopt a philosophy that says, uvecholso, nevertheless, I'm going for it. I'm going for it because God said so. I'm going for it because that's where history is at. I'm going for it for whatever reason. And then they get here and suddenly things look very different. You travel a lot. I'm sure you've had that experience. It's like going through the looking glass. You're here, and you see the world through the lens of Eretz Yisrael. And then you go, forget reading the media, forget, you know, just simply the physical experience of getting outside of Israel and looking at the world and saying, oh, I get it. It looks very different from out here.
It's interesting because there's there were two little stories that I wanted to tell you that happened to me this week that related exactly to what you just said, this looking glass. First was that... This week was the yahrzeit of Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, and I was not far from the cemetery, and I said, I want to go. And I went to the cemetery, and before I went to Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, I went to visit my dad, who's buried pretty close by. So I went to visit my dad, and then there's another tzaddik, Rav Zilber, who's buried there, a famous kind of Russian tzaddik. And there were like other Russian Jews there, and then this Russian Jew said to people around him, I need to make, to say Kaddish. So can you join me? That happens a lot in the cemetery. People are like, they need a tenth. They need a few more people for 10 men for a quorum. So the guy says to me, where do you live? He goes, do you live in America? Because he heard me speaking in English and I had my New York Yankees hat. So I said, no, God forbid, I live in Jerusalem. He says, why do you say God forbid? I mean, a Jew can keep Torah anywhere. And I'm like, well, there's an ingathering of the exiles right now. And the guy, older Jew, says to me, you know, an older Russian Jew came out of one of these, you know, Kazakhstan places. He says to me, "What are you talking about? There is no ingathering of the exiles." He's like, "In kibbutz," and he said to me, "Russian, there's no kibbutz galiot right now. There's no ingathering of the exiles." I thought he might have been joking with me. So I'm like, "Are you joking?" He's like, he kind of turned it back to me. He's like, and then he turned to a few other ultra orthodox people who were there. He's like, "Is there an ingathering of the exiles now, or is that like a different time, messianic times, and sometime in the future?" I'm like, I just pointed to Yerushalayim. I'm like, "Look," I said to him, "I'm a simple Jew. So I'll just look at Yerushalayim." And he just looked at me, and I looked at him, and it was just like, I was just like, "Oh my God!" It's like, you know. It's what's the reality out there? Yeah. That's story number one. Story number two is that I'm giving a talk to a British group, and I make the claim that Palestinianism is really a tactic of the jihad, secular jihad and religious jihad, to try to oust Israel. And she goes, this girl raises her hand. She's like, "You say that Palestinianism is really rooted in jihad. I've never heard that," she says to me. "Like, I've never heard that. Can you please explain it?" Later on, she turned out to be quite liberal. But it was just like, I looked at her at first. I'm like, "You mean you haven't heard this stuff? You haven't been to their Facebook page? You haven't heard that at least, I mean, you've heard that some." She was like, "No. It's like a liberation movement." And again, I was just like awestruck by the looking glassness of like, reality perceived. I thought, you know, okay, most people would be like, "Well, yeah, there's a little bit of
heard
that.
This, heard that."
Right. Well, in the gathering of the exiles, I mean, it's not maybe the end of the exiles,
but there are
some.
6 million Jews from all over the world that have come here in the last 70 years.
But again, it's like the philosophy. There's a far, what do you call it? A chasm
right.
between. At least the way, it scared me because I was just like, "Oh, another thing this girl said to me is," I said to her, "Listen, I think you've been mistaught about what Palestinianism is and what the rights of the Jews are." She goes, "By saying that, you're delegitimizing me."
Uh-huh.
I'm like, by saying that I'm delegitimizing you, you're actually delegitimizing me.
Oh, because
I'm not
that?
I don't know. She was like, "I'm like, I'm actually not trying to delegitimize you. I would never." And by you saying that about me, it takes away my position as though we're not having a conversation anymore.
Yeah, it's precisely what it was doing.
And right. I think
it is a major intellectual tactic today that instead of coming to sort of to battle on the field of ideas like you and I were raised, right? Like, "Well, man, say it like it is. You might have to be decent and nice. You don't want to be, you know, like sort of ad hominem personal attacks. But let's duke it out." So no, today the virtue is placed on safety and acceptance of other as the primary, and therefore what it does is anybody who asserts something against you has become an aggressor. Right? It is a major problem that we're dealing with. There's a piece in Korach. I feel like it's connected to this looking glass phenomenon, right? You know, the Moshe. Again, he's seeing the world through the lens of God, right? There's this wonderful line later in the book of Deuteronomy, "We should make it there, please God," right? Where it describes Moshe as Tmunat Hashem Ibit, right? Which you would translate as how? How would you translate that?
He sees the image. He looks directly to the image of God.
Right, which is deeply problematic, isn't it? Since Moshe is the one that will tell us, no images, please, no images.
Right, but that's exactly it. Meaning to say there's no images that you can engrave. But there is an image of God somehow, and he sees it. In any case, in our terms and languages, he's speaking to me face to face.
So I've been taught...
Whatever God's face means. By the way, God calls, says, he blesses us with his face.
Yeah, for sure. And we'll get... We passed it.
Yeah.
But my point was is that there's another way to read it, which is that he sees the world through God's eyes, meaning Tmunat Hashem Ibit. He's seeing the vision from the godly perspective, right? And so it's a great example. Tehillah, right? The mitzvah of putting a blue string on the four-cornered garment. Korach famously in the rabbinic literature comes to Moshe and says, "You're telling me all these mitzvot are so important? Here's a talit shekulo tehillah, right? Clothing, a piece of, help
a
me out there.
A piece of cloth.
A piece of cloth. But it's a clothing.
A garment.
A garment, that's the word, right? It's all made of tehillah. Do I have to hang a blue string on it?" Moshe says, "Well, of course you do. Like, what? That's the law. And Karach gets everybody to laugh at him. Like, ah, like the whole thing's made in Techelet and it's not good enough. And now he's telling me you got to put like the one string on it. And I mean, why? Because Karach is trying to pull out from it this. No, this is a comprehensible human endeavor. And right. We understand Moshe's agenda. And said, Moshe's looking from the perspective of God, which says, no, I told you to do this. If you live this way, maybe you'll come to understand what it is. But don't expect to have to understand it in order to live this way. Right? Those are completely inverted ways of seeing the world.
By the way, I just want you to know that people like my mom, when they read Parshat Korach, they're like, he's a communist. Immediately, like they're like
well,
they like
everybody's holy, everybody's the same.
Well, yeah, his whole argument is like power to the people, and you know you leaders, you know you're the power holders. You're the evil people in this world. And for people like my mom, who come out of the Soviet Union, it's like they really see Korach as this Jew that they know, this Trotskyite that they're they spot him right in this text.
That's a frightening thought.
Yeah, that's how the way they see it. Okay. So you said something before that I wanted to riff off of, which is you said that Moses split the sea.
Right.
It made me think that in this week's Torah portion, we see another split and another creation, another unusual thing. And that is the way that Korach and his family go down is Moses said, if I'm not serving God, then if I am a true messenger of God, then the way you're going to die is through a creation that has never been before. And the earth is going to open up. There's going to be an earthquake the way we understand it, but there's going to be a crack in the earth, and it will swallow them, the Korachites and the whole rebellion. It will swallow them whole. Is that maybe an allusion to those who didn't believe in God's splitting of the sea? Meaning to say there's like a new kind of split, and this one is instead of saving you, it's swallowing you up. Like, what is the, there's this whole, like, there's imagery here of, like, the earth itself eating them, swallowing them. And then we, of course, also hear later in the Talmud that you could still hear them, like, singing songs for God from below the earth.
Well, right, because what I find so powerful is the text actually says that they went alive down to...
Right, they went down...
To Sheolah, right? And there's no real word for hell in the Bible, but there are a few words that get worked into that much later concept. But they went alive down into the deeps. Why alive? Because I think what this is pulling out, at least in a metaphorical sense, is the fact that truth is these people were already in hell. They were already living in a godless, empty world. As soon as Korach decided that what was most important was power, and that he was willing to defy even Moshe and therefore even God in order to get it, then the earth opening itself up and swallowing him down alive into this dark place was just an expression of the world in which he already lived. In the same way, and I think that there's a right parallel here to the splitting of the Red Sea, right? Who splits the Red Sea? It's Nachshon ben Aminadab, right? But he goes all the way in, says the Midrash, to the point where the water reached his nostrils. Why? Because he thought at the last minute God would save him? No, because he was already living in a godly world, and he knew that the world would respond. Because the world creation is a responsive creation. Creation is not some sort of like static phenomenon where, well, things happen and everything's a coincidence. And so, no, the world, nor is it, I believe, like God is like some puppet master that's constantly, you know, like pulling strings and making sure things. No, no. God created a world in which is when we approach him through the world, so he approaches us. Nachshon moves into the sea, and God says, well, there you go. I'm going to split it. Korach defies God, and he says, wow, you're already living in hell. I'll show you that it's true. And the earth opens itself up and swallows him. Right? And it is a source of tremendous hope in my mind, but it's also one of great fear in terms of, you know, the world could go many ways.
And similarly, the spies sent a bad message about the land of Israel, that it's a land that eats its inhabitants. Rabbi Nachman says, that's actually a good midah. That's actually a good thing. It eats its inhabitants. It swallows them. It ingests them. So it makes you part of the land of Israel. You become really, really, what's the word?
Integrated, infused
into the wholeness of this land. And when it doesn't swallow you up,
it spits you out. Oh, that's very strong.
Yeah,
image.
He says it spits you out. He says the opposite. The land of Israel is a land that will take you in and make you part of it, right?
You know, I also heard a beautiful thought on that, in that Ochelet et Yosheveha, right, the land eats those who sit. Right, this is a place, as you well know, you got to be moving, man. We're moving forward. There's
no
standing still here.
That's right. Or the people say, Atzat Hashem hi takum. The advice of God is it will arise. But another way to read that is the advice of God is get up. Okay, so that's another thing. All right. This week's Torah portion, many years ago, I read it also in Amsterdam. Why do I remember that? I was in Amsterdam, and Amsterdam, a beautiful city, a very special city, is also famous in part for its flowers.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, there were very beautiful colors there. There was a lot of gray because of the rains there, but also the sun would come in, and I went to there's a whole flower market. It's like a big thing there. And exactly that Shabbat, I read about how God was trying to prove who the leader of the Jewish people was by saying to the heads of the tribes, hey, hand in your
staffs
to the Aron Kodesh, to the inner sanctum, and put it in front of the Ark of the Covenant, and God will show you who the leader is. And at the end, what happens is the next morning they come in, and the staff of Levi, staff of Aaron, flowers with the beautiful, famous flower of the land of Israel, which is the Shkidiyah, the almond flower, and it actually yields a fruit. And that was supposed to be a sign. Everybody was very, very desperate after seeing both Korach go down into the ground and then 250 of his followers with the fire pans get killed through the coming down of a fire that burnt them all up totally. And so the Jewish people were like, oh my God, there's like a death thing going on here. We're like in a desert, and now, like, you know,
people
fires
getting burnt up, they're getting swallowed by the earth.
It's like this ain't good.
The spies had that nasty end we didn't talk about last week.
Right, which is like the their tongues came out and they got
filled with worms, went down in their stomachs. It's like really, yeah, bad news.
Bad news. So people were getting a little bit upset about that. By the way, if you hear background noise, we are at the Western Wall right now in one of the little tunnels. I hear people singing Am Yisrael Chai. Today's Thursday. There are bar mitzvahs here, bat mitzvahs.
I saw a guy loaded down with tear gas canisters and a helmet putting on tefillin about 10 minutes ago. It's an image you just don't get anywhere else.
Another thing that they have here today is that a lot of people who are like looking for jobs have become these people in white. They put on these white turbans, white shirts, white pants, white shoes. And they have shofarot, and what they do is that they go together with bar and bat mitzvahs, and they like play the drums and blow the shofar and become
awesome.
these shofar cheerleaders.
Yeah, bar mitzvah cheerleaders. That's what they are. Yeah.
they're the entourage.
Yeah.
Rent an entourage. It's really fun. So I was just saying that there's this like flower thing, which is God's like, no, the flower symbolizes like there is peace. Yes, he's the leader, but also there's, I don't know, what do you think this like beautiful flower, like an old staff that is certainly a dead tree, comes to life?
Two things it says to me. First of all, and it's so important to remember that the primary focus of the Torah is uvecharta v'chaim. Choose life. We are people who are about life. And life is not found through some sort of narrow-sighted pursuit of power. Life is with God. And God says, I'm going to prove it to you. See this stick? It's been dead. I mean, it's not been dead. You've been using it as a staff. You've been walking in the desert for 40 years with this stick. Is there life in it? And the answer is, only you know, God. And Aaron is the one who really encapsulates that. The other thing you brought up for me, which I actually have never thought about before, is at the beginning of the book of Jeremiah, when God, in what is one of the most revealing passages about what prophecy really is, says to Jeremiah, what do you see? You remember what the first thing he sees is? Makel Shakid. Right, it's a staff of an almond tree, and there God says, you know, you're seeing good, right? Because ani shakarati, right? I'm always on the watch. I'm sort of waiting and intensely focused in order, in that case, lo aleinu, to bring evil on Am Yisrael. But I believe that the shakid, you know, it's the first to flower, right? And with that, that wonderful Zionist children's song that I love, Ashkiri Aporachet, right? I love to sing it every year in the spring, over and over until my wife goes nuts. The kids won't stop. So, but it teaches us, like I said, is that the God is not some like far off, distant, you know, God of the philosophers who started some process going, and if you know the rules, you can just play it out to your advantage, like Korach thought. It's right here. It's right here, right? And that's what brings real life. So like God says, I'm so present that I can take something dead and make it fruit and flower. But you have to know that Aaron is the one who does the daily work, to in the in. the Mishkan and the tabernacle and between people and bringing them back together in intimacy to show that God is always present. It's not sort of like some distant waiting figure. It's right here.
And that, so that's the nice version of the flowering staff. There's a different version that the Baal Turim talks about, that actually the staff did what it did back in Egypt, which it swallowed. Remember, it swallowed the staffs,
right,
that turned to snakes of the Egyptians. He says it swallowed the other staffs here also.
Whoa.
And then when they got there, they opened it up and there was only one staff. And people were like, hey, is there some hanky-panky? And then it started coughing them up. It coughed up the other staffs. And goes, here you go. And it like threw them back out. And it's like, okay. So there was a power thing. Finally, I want to do just one more story here, and that is more Jews are complaining, and the people start talking bad against Aaron, against Moses. The complaining is something that God really doesn't like, and this is something that was pointed out to me by Rav Arush, who really just shows you that one of the main things that God doesn't like is complaining. Remember that, folks. That's like one of the worst kind of things you could do. So instead of thanking God for your life, and that's what Rav Arush teaches, thank God for everything and don't complain about it. And thank him for the problems as well.
Just a practical thing. My wife and I do this periodically. If you can challenge yourselves to a week of not complaining to each other,
right,
you will find that your relationship shifts in a. I don't mean complaining about each other, God forbid. I mean actually complaining to each other, mm-hmm, about other things. Mm-hmm. It can shift the nature of your communication in a major way.
Well, it's interesting you say that because today, the 28th of Sivan, is also the first day of the spies going into the land of Israel for 40 days until, uh-huh, Tisha B'Av. This is a great time to fix the sin of evil speech, bad speech, slanderous speech.
It's true.
And in this case, also complaining speech. And I believe in. I've wanted to run this for a few years now, which is 40 days of speaking good about Israel. And in general, 40 days of like speaking good.
Bli Neder, I'm going to take that on.
Yeah, it's exactly at this time.
Today.
Until Tisha B'Av.
Your birthday.
Yes. My birthday is the day when the spies get in. That's right. So in
you
any case.
You are a tikkun for that, my friend.
I'm trying. And so I'm trying to do my part in any case.
You're doing it.
And then they complain. The Jews are complaining. Uh-oh, God's like, this time God's not even talking anymore. Now he's actually starting to. You know, he said in the past, you know, just let me at him. Just let me at our Jews. And Moses is like, no. Hold me back. No. Don't hurt the Jews. It's going to be bad for your name.
In this case,
there's like a fiery plague starts to hit the Jews. Moses says to Aaron, listen, take this
incense pan
and walk quickly to the Jews, for the plague has begun. Aaron takes and do atonement for them. Aaron takes the incense pan, runs, doesn't walk quickly, runs and stands right in front of the plague, which plagues, the Torah tells us, our rabbis tell us, that once the plague goes, it's gonna take the good guys along with it.
Let loose, yeah.
Right. And Aaron, so selflessly, so unafraid, you know, for himself, stands right there in front of the Jewish people who have sinned.
Yeah,
you know, God, you know, I'm gonna
against him personally.
I'm gonna tell God what to do. Me,
right.
I'm gonna tell God to stop right here. Yeah, I'm gonna tell him to stop killing Jews right now.
And against him personally, it's the
right.
exact opposite of Korach.
My God,
well, but
my
you
God.
See why he was chosen.
Exactly. It's like this is Aaron's moment, and he stands between the living and the dead, atones for them, and the plague stops. What a, I mean that to me is like. Where art should be. Like, I would like to see that depicted, you know? Mm. I'd like to see that. Like, Aaron standing right between the living and the dead with his like, and looking up to God and calling, asking for expiation, for penitence, for tshuva.
And at the risk of his own life.
Amazing. That to me is like a that's an art moment, you know what I mean?
It's also an ideal of leadership. I think of, you know, we're sitting here at the Kotel and it's just incredible merit to be here. And I think of some of the early leadership in particular that this country merited to people, you know, like Ben Gurion, who really, I mean, died a poor man, you know, and stood between life and death in terms of coming out of the Holocaust and the birth of the State of Israel. And I believe that the divine success that they merited was because it was not about them.
Yeah. There's basically no more powerful force in this world than Mesirut Nefesh.
True.
That's the one you mentioned also, of course, Nachshon Ben Aminadav, but Mesirut Nefesh, which is self-sacrifice for the greater cause, it's the highest thing.
It changes the world.
It changes the world. That's what changes the world. Rabbi Mike Foyer, I want to thank you very much for joining me on my birthday here at the Western Wall. And
I'm sorry, I would have brought a cake if I'd known.
That's all right. It's also the day of the beginning of the spies journeying the land. It's also actually the anniversary of last night was actually Layl El Qadr, which is a big Muslim holiday, which is the holiday of power when, you know, Dr. M came up with this Quran. Not, you know, this not, but this is part of what's going on here atmospherically. It's also the day that the Entebbe plane was taken. So many 41 years ago. And I was born on that date, so then you can guess how old I am.
Wait, don't tell me.
So it's definitely a powerful date. I want to thank you, and I also want to bless you for continued success, strength, continued great broadcasting, and I mean that in the broadest sense of the word broadcasting, of God's truth. He's relying on us to be his broadcasters and relying on you, and I want to wish you a lot of hatzlacha and success.
Amen.
And also success in staying healthy, alive for a long time, and with that, also in raising of children.
Oh,
and the blessing of really not just having that treasure inside our hearts and even broadcasting, but also being able to pass it to the next generation.
Amen.
And with that, folks, we finish up this part of the Yishai Fleischer Show on the Land of Israel Network. My email is yishai@thelandofisrael.com. Rav Mike is reachable at?
Rav Mike at thelandofisrael.com.
Rav Mike@thelandofisrael.com, and his show is The Jewish Story. And we just talked about the next generation. Stay tuned right now for my lively, I would say hyper talk, with a group of young Jewish leaders yesterday at the Foreign Ministry. There's a high energy, hyper discussion that you're going to be privy to. Luckily, I smartly recorded it, and you're going to enjoy it, I think. You are listening to the show, and we are broadcasting live from Yerushalayim. God is broadcasting from Yerushalayim. His Torah is being broadcast from Yerushalayim. All you have to do is tune in. So tune in, stay strong, stay part of the story, and stay tuned. Here's the next part of the Yishai Fleischer Show. God bless you, and shalom.
Martyrdom does not end something, said Indira Gandhi. It is only a beginning. And for me, each episode is a new beginning, because I'm telling a story of the past set to build a present identity that's motivated to make the future of which we dream. I'm Rav Mike Foyer, and this is The Jewish Story.
Listen to The Jewish Story with Rav Mike Foyer on thelandofisrael.com.
Hebron is where the mothers and the fathers of the Jewish people are buried. No other nation has such an incredible site. We have an incredible site. Who's been to Hebron? Okay? All right, about a third of the people. So a lot of you haven't been there. And Hebron is about an hour south of Jerusalem. And if you've been to Gush Etzion, it's about 22 minutes past Gush Etzion into an area that's mostly an Arab area, an area which is in large part also the Palestinian Authority. And suddenly, when you drive through the Palestinian Authority and wherever you're allowed to drive on these roads, suddenly you take a turn in through Kiryat Arba, and then you have this, then you cross over into Hebron, and there's 85 Jewish families. Together with the 8,500 Jews that live in Kiryat Arba, makes a block of 10,000 Jews amongst about 160,000, 170,000, 180,000 Arabs. Okay? And so the existence of Jewish Hebron is not specifically or naturally pragmatic. It's not exactly pragmatic. It's maybe problematic. And so therefore we have to ask the question, why are Jews there? Well, the simple answer to why our Jews there is that we've always been there. We've been there for about 4,000 years, 3,800 years ago. Here's the history of Hebron. I'm going to give it to you. I'm going to give you 4,000 years in 60 seconds, okay? 4,000 years ago, according to tradition, Abraham buries Sarah there, and then the rest of the biblical family is buried in this one place, except for Rachel, except for Joseph, but Abraham and Sarah, Avraham and Sarah, Yitzchak and Rivka, and Yaakov and Leah. Okay, they're buried there. By the way, Yaakov, according to the Bible story, dies in Egypt, says to his children, don't bury me here in Egypt, bury me in Maariv HaMachpelah. And they're like, okay, and he makes them swear, and they bury him in the same place in Hebron. There's a whole procession. Okay, so that was, what, 3,800 years ago. Let's just call that 4,000 years. 4,000 years ago. 3,000 years ago, King David is crowned king over all of Israel in Hebron. All right, in Hebron. So Hebron is actually the first capital of all of Israel. 2,000 years ago, and here's now. You could dispute with me if you want about King David and stuff. No problem. 2,000 years ago, you already can't dispute. All right? 2,000 years ago, a Jewish king, albeit a weird one, named King Herod, builds a building. That building is a monumental tomb structure. It's written up in Josephus. There's no doubt about it. It's got the same stones as the Kotel. Those framed stones. You know, when you come to the Kotel, you're like, you come to the Kotel and you look at it and it's got like a, as though like a kind of frame around it that's like inset. Have you noticed that? It's not just like a flat wall.
I've only been a couple times.
Okay, no problem. You'll notice it next time. It's called the framed Herodian stone, or the Herodian masonry. And that was 2,000 years ago. He builds a monumental structure. He's a Jewish king who builds a Jewish building so that Jewish people would know where their fathers and mothers are. By the way, just two small parentheses. One, according to Jewish tradition, Adam and Eve are buried there. It's not in the Bible. You don't have to believe that. But what's important about that is that if you do believe it, or if you like the concept of it, doesn't even matter if it's true or not, it means that it's also the foundation of all of humanity. Humanity has a connection to this place, okay? The other thing I want to point out to you is that, this is my second parenthesis. Let's say you wanted to go to America, and you want, how many of us are from America here? Okay, the rest, what are we? South America, South Americans?
Europe.
Everywhere. France.
French, okay.
Chile.
New Zealand.
India.
Who's from New Zealand?
Brazil.
All right. Belgium, India, what do we got?
There's Mumbai.
Mumbai, awesome.
Chile.
Okay.
24. Chile as well.
Fantastic.
Czech Republic,
beautiful.
Poland, on and on.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's good. I've been to like 50 or 60% of those. Czech Republic, great place. I have a Czech gun. Who's from the Czech Republic? Great folks. Okay.
South Africa.
I'm heading out there. All right. So wait. If you now I'll have to just be for a second. Really, please do not believe that I'm America centric. I'm not. But let's say you wanted to go see the founding members of America. Where would you go? Have you guys been to Washington D.C.? There's the Washington Monument. There's the Lincoln Memorial. There's the what do you call it? You go to what do you call Mount Rushmore? You see four presidents. What do all these people have in common in America? These founders of America.
They're all men.
They're white men. That's exactly right. Ding, ding, ding. They're white men. That's right. If you want to go see the founders of the Jewish people, it's not a men's thing. It's mothers and fathers. It's okay. Two by two. Okay? We're not a idea. The Jewish people are an ethnicity, a race, a peoplehood, a family that gives birth to a nation. So understand it that way. It's mothers and fathers. Mothers and fathers. That's a big difference. That's the end of parentheses number two. Where were we? 2,000 years ago, Herod builds a big, beautiful monument. It's there today. Unbroken. Never touched. It still serves today what it served 2,000 years ago. Then you have 1,000 years ago, a great Jewish philosopher, thinker, Maimonides, Rambam. He comes to Hebron. He writes a letter. I was here. I prayed at this place. 500 years ago. 700 years ago, the Mamluks take over. Do you know what the Mamluks are? It's a type of Egyptian that took over this region. They are not so nice. They kick out the Jews out of our own building. And they say, hey, guess what? This is a Muslim building now. You're out. And Abraham, he's a Muslim. And you have nothing to do with this place. They just kick us out. And for 700 years, from 1267 to 1967, 1267 to 1967, we were kicked out of our own building. And the building was now renamed the Ibrahimi Mosque, okay? 500 years ago, that was 700 years ago. 500 years ago, Jews are kicked out from Spain, 1492, right? And a lot of them come to Hebron. They're kicked out and they move through North Africa, through Southern Europe, get to the land of Israel. Turkey's in control, they make it to the land of Israel. 500 years ago, Spanish Jews set up a new synagogue and a new community in Hebron. That's 500 years ago. And we had great relations with the Arabs for 500 years until 1929. 1929, there's a bad guy. Bad guy, his name is Haj Amin al-Husseini. Haj Amin al-Husseini, very long and very sad story why he takes power. Very sad why he actually gets control, because it didn't have to be that way. It didn't have to be that his version of Islam, his jihadist slash Nazi, there are many pictures of him in collab with Hitler. He was actually part of a Bosnian unit to make sure that trains
from Europe that passed through Bosnia, that no Jews would escape. He was part of the final solution. He, sadly, for various reasons, takes power, and his agenda takes over. By the way, 1919 peace conference in Paris, okay? 1919 peace conference in Paris. Emir Faisal from the Hejaz, from Saudi Arabia, meets with Chaim Weizmann. And do you know what they do? Check it out on Wikipedia. You can read it for yourself. They exchange letters. And in these letters, they say the following. Here's what Emir Faisal, a great Arab leader, says. Welcome, my brothers. You are my Semitic brothers. Come to your land. Let us rise up together, a Jewish country, a Semitic country, along with the Arab countries around. Let us, you guys will help us because you're good at stuff. And we'll help you because we're from here. We'll rise up together and we'll help each other. These are letters, 1919. No difference between today and yesterday. Same people, same place. But there was a completely different concept that Emir Faisal was saying. And Chaim Weizmann, of course, was such a beautiful vision. Sadly, only 10 years later, an evil jihadist takes over. 1929, 1921 riots in Jerusalem, 1929 riot in Hebron. 67 Jews are murdered in a horrific fashion. ISIS, not a new thing. And at the time, the British are in charge. The British don't really like the Jewish Israeli presence. They kick out the Jews out of Hebron, breaking 3,800 years of life in Hebron. 1967, we come back. And here's the question. Is it liberation or occupation? Liberation or occupation? Are we occupying somebody else's land or are we coming back to our ancestral homeland? The houses that we live in today are the houses that were taken away from us in 1929. Majority of them anyway. That tomb structure that was once renamed as somebody else's tomb is our structure. Our king built it. We're from here. Our moms and dads are here. Now, why am I sweating a little bit? Why am I sweating? Because literally, I got a call last night that Tzipi Chotubeli, the deputy foreign minister here, wants. Okay, don't be embarrassed. It's okay. It's all right. It's okay. I'm sure you're good people. What is UNESCO to me? UNESCO to me, I'm going to say something radical, but let's just have some fun, right? Because you don't want to be bored. UNESCO is the legitimate arm of the jihad. The legitimate arm of the jihad. These guys, what are they in charge of? They're in charge of making sure that history is upkept, that people remember history, that history isn't erased, and yet they are actively in history erasure. That is what they do. That is what they do. They literally say, Jews, you were never on the Temple Mount. Oh, did I say Temple Mount? I meant Al-Aqsa. You guys are not from here. Okay? It's true that inside of the Al-Aqsa, not Al-Aqsa, inside the Dome of the Rock, there are writings in Arabic that say, here's where the temple stood. Okay, don't worry about that. It's true that the Waqf writes in their books in the 20s, this is where two temples stood. Don't worry about that. Today, UNESCO, which is the white suit-wearing, tie-wearing, European good folks, you have to trust them, are saying to us, Jews, you were never from here. And of course, therefore, there is no jihad against us. There's actually a freedom liberation movement, a self-determination against us, the occupiers. If we're foreigners, then the attack against us is totally legitimate. If we are holding on to somebody else's land, if we're thieves, then it's totally right to fight thieves. It's totally right to fight thieves. But if we are actually the people of this land, if we're the indigenous or an indigenous people here, and that building is actually our building, we're from here, then we're not in occupation, we're in liberation. Before I ever make talks like this, and so that's why I was at a meeting. I was in Hebron this morning. I had to do a VIP tour of important people. Then I ran to the office, finished the paperwork for Chotubeli. Then I ran to Chotubeli. There was traffic because today is Eid al-Adha, which is a big Muslim holiday. Big traffic from Hebron to Yerushalayim. Got stuck. Went to Chotubeli's office just now, sat with her, then ran here, okay? That's why I'm a little bit sweating, a little bit hyped up, all right? Before I ever give any talk, I always like to say one simple thing. I am not trying to convince you, I'm not trying to teach you, I'm not trying to get into your head, okay? I'm sharing with you my narrative. Don't believe me, think it's BS, look it up on Wikipedia, you don't have to trust me, but you do have to accept that I do represent, in official capacity, the general settler narrative. Okay, you know the word settler, is that a good word or a bad word? What do you think? Good word, what do you think?
Me?
Yeah, what do you think?
Lately a bad word, but the word settler was more naturally taken some years ago, especially in other regions of the world.
Yeah.
But if you talk about, sometimes it's all about the narrative. So in what about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the narrative is so important that some words take pejorative in the moment that you hear them. So one of them is settler.
Good answer.
From the story you're telling, it's inaccurate to use that term.
Absolutely, correct.
But you're saying this narrative reflects that of settlers in general? They're all reclaiming sites as you've described, or can you...
Two good questions there. One is, you're absolutely right, the word settler is not a good word. It's a pejorative word.
Returner
or resettler or let's call it, you know, indigenous peoples, coming back to homeland. Aboriginal native peoples. Absolutely, 100% believe that. But recently I started taking the word settler as exactly in what I call, what you just alluded to very well, is what I call the narrative war. And in the narrative war, I've decided to take a tack. Do you remember when the word gay used to be a bad word? No. I don't know if you were in your... Right. Okay, the word gay used to be like a bad word. It was like a pejorative, like a negative word that's like a slur. But then they turned it and they started using it as a positive. I'm like, wait a minute.
Well, before that, it meant something else too.
Right, okay. But anyway, when we were kids, that was like a bad word, okay? I said settler... That is a bad word, because it means that you're not really from the place, that you're like an occupier or a colonialist, right?
A stranger.
And it's not a good word. I don't even like that word, certainly. But I started saying, you know what? If people know that word, I'm going to use it, and I'm going to use it backwards. I'm going to start being like, yeah, I am a settler. A settler is a Jew who wants to live in these forward places, which are our biblical homeland, our historical homeland. By the way, don't get stuck. Did you hear me say that God gave us the land? You didn't hear me say that, right? I didn't say anything like that. I'm talking about, I might believe that, but I'm not going to say that to you. I'm going to say it's our historic homeland. We've been here for 3,000 years, 3,800 years. The world recognized our rights here. And I am a Jew who's willing to live in this part of the land and to push back on bad guys and to push against the two-state solution. Because I don't want anybody coming to my small country, taking away my important strategic and central heartland and making a Palestinian state there or any other state there. Okay? Look, we've tried land for peace. Have we tried land for peace?
Yes,
we tried it. Recently we tried it with Gaza. How did that work out, you think? You don't think it worked that well? Recently I just was debating Shalom Achshav, peace now, and the guy was like sitting in front of a serious audience and he's like, no, that was a good move. Gaza worked out. And I'm like, dude, you know, it's like nobody in Israel thinks that, okay? We've had three horrific wars in 6 years, and these dudes are tunneling underneath all the time and rocketeering against us. It did not work out. It did not work out. And like by saying that in front of this audience, you're like exposing yourself as being like out there like loony, all right? Like giving land for peace or giving land away sounds like a good idea. It used to sound like a good idea. But today, it's clear that it's not going to work. It never was going to work for the following simple reasons. One, this region is... How many Arabs live in this region? In this region, the Middle East, how many Arabs live here?
Millions.
Millions.
Come on, don't give me cop-out answers. Huh? This is an important little fact that I hope that you memorize for the rest of from here on in. There's about 360 million Arabs in this region. Not Muslims, Arabs, okay? 360 million, there's about a billion plus Muslims in the world, but in this region there's about 360 million Arabs. How many Jews are there in this region?
Seven.
Six and a half, okay? 6.4 million Jews, okay? Just get that picture. Big Arab Middle East, tiny little Jewish state. What's nice about it is that we're all Semitic peoples, we're actually related. Right, we actually have the same genes, we have the same similar language, similar religion and all that. So we're actually related folks. But understand that our little country is a haven from 2,000 years of persecution and a haven of a region that has been not easy for us. It's a tiny little country, okay, in the corner of this region. Now, if you give away more of this small little land, which is the highland, controlling highland, you very well may get what happened in Gaza, which is the jihad uses it as a forward base, as a forward base. Now, I wanna run a little exercise. Are you watching? You wanna play a game? Here we go, let's play a game. This is my great grandfather's glasses, okay, his Oakleys, okay, and he got this from his great grandfather. We've passed it down for generations, these Oakleys, and I wanna give it to you for peace.
Thank you.
How does that sound?
Great.
It sounds nice, right?
Yeah.
What do you think about me as I give this to you?
It's nice and generous.
Nice and generous. And you're willing to compromise for peace.
Catch?
There's no catch. That's the. That if does it sound good to you or not?
No, it sounds as if they didn't really have a value for you.
Okay, good, good. That's one way. Good analysis. What are you, Israeli? What was that accent?
No, I'm from Slovakia.
Slovakia, very good. Okay.
What?
Yeah.
Okay. As if you do not value it.
Okay, that's what she said. That's a similar thing. There's another way to understand it, which is, I'm weak. I want to do anything for peace. I'm willing to, in the Middle East, if I say, here, take Jerusalem, just take half of Jerusalem, just let's have peace. It sounds like, oh my God, the other guy is totally spineless. He's a wimp, he's a sissy. He's willing to give up his Jerusalem, or I'm willing to give up Hebron, where my mothers and fathers are buried. Take the tombs of my fathers and mothers, just give me peace. Imagine a first night in jail, right? You guys know what I'm talking about, right? First night in jail, right? First night in jail, you just come out to the yard, you're like, hey everybody, I just want peace. How does that sound? What's going to happen, okay? You cannot talk like that in the Middle East. Land for peace is a sissy-ish way of talking, which smells bad in the nose.
That's a sexist word.
Is it?
And homophobic.
Okay, let's use a different word. A weak way, okay?
Okay.
I don't mean it. I thought sissiest was gender neutral, but if you tell me different, then I'll accept that. There's no gender issue here. I'm talking about specifically weakness that the other side may understand as weakness. That's all I mean. Okay? And so the two-state solution, land for peace, was always going to fail. It was always going to fail. In this region, you don't give up land. In 55 land conflicts in this region, only one party says, if I give away more land, there'll be peace. Okay? Nobody in this region talks like that. And here's where the real colonialism comes in. When the West tells us that the only solution is the two-state solution, that is cultural colonialism. That is an idea that comes from a different country. If you're shopping at Walmart, there's one way of shopping, but if you try to shop at Walmart in the shuk here at Machane Yehuda, you're not gonna get to buy anything, okay? You're not gonna be able to get anything, because different rules. The Middle East has different rules. And therefore, the two-state solution was always going to fail, has always failed, and has only empowered jihadism, and has also done even something even worse that you may be victims of, which is it has actually managed to empower the jihad to say that we are colonialists, that we are stealing somebody else's land. And the scariest thing of them all today is that they've managed to take our kids, Jewish kids, on American campuses and other places around the world, which you know better, and have turned them against Israel. Our own people today believe that Israel is a thief, an occupier, a colonialist, a rapist, I don't know. And if young people are going to believe that, then we're going to lose a whole generation. Does anybody know what I'm talking about here?
Sorry.
There's a lot of excitement here. I said something.
You never answered my other question, by the way. What
was your question?
You said your narrative reflects that of all settlers, and I asked if other settlement areas have the same connection.
Yes.
About areas.
Yes. I will. I'll take questions. Here we go. Everybody, calm down. Here we go. I'm going to shut up now. I'm going to take your questions. But remember to ask me. Somebody's got to ask me. What is the right-wing alternative to the two-state solution? Because I only made fun of two-state solution, but we actually do have suggestions. Let me answer this young lady first. She asked first. The answer is, good point. And the answer is absolutely. For example, I lived in the town of Beit El, right? Bethel. That's the original Bethel. Many places around the world are called Bethel. Beit El is where Jacob had his dream of the ladder. Shechem, or Nablus, is where Joseph's tomb is. It's been destroyed by jihadist elements. Mm-hmm. By the way, I use the word jihadist because I refuse to use the word Arab, which is a nation and a peoplehood, and I refuse to use the word Muslim, because that's a big religion.
You call them all jihadists?
No,
oh,
the opposite.
Oh, okay.
The opposite. I am limiting the fight against those people who have an intolerant supremacist ideology. I'm saying the opposite. I was last Thursday I was in Istanbul meeting with Muslim clerics who think that Israel is a good thing and she has a right to exist according to the Quran. We're always meeting with Arabs and Muslims, whatever it is, that have a different approach. Therefore, I refuse to use that. The jihad is a much more limited phenomenon. It's like using the word, let's say, we had a war with Germany or do we have a war with Nazis? Nazis is an ideology. I don't have an ethnic problem with Germans. I have a problem with ideology. So I've tried to use that word. Many other places, especially, of course, Jerusalem, where I live on the... I don't live in Hebron. I live on the Mount of Olives. In Jerusalem, in East Jerusalem, that, of course, is where all of Jewish history was. It's a mountain of 3,000 years of Jewish burial, right across from Temple Mount, etc. So yes, the biblical stories took place in West Bank, Judea, and Samaria. And also the majority of Jewish history took place in these places, okay? So yes, there's a long connection for most settlers to where they live. Sir.
Yes, thanks so much. Thank you so much for coming. Really enjoyed your speech. My question is just a little bit long, but not really long. So.
As long as there's a question mark at
there
the end.
There is a question mark at the end. Okay, so 4 hours ago, we met with somebody from the Palestinian community who is really in touch with the under 40 population. He lives in the PA, and he said that the under 40 Palestinian population has something in common with the Israeli right, in that they are increasingly in support of a one-state solution. One day Mahmoud Abbas is going to die.
One day soon.
And a young Palestinian will say, you know, let's tear apart the Palestinian Authority and ask the Israelis to annex the entirety of the West Bank and have responsibility for the social well-being of the Palestinians.
You have this dude's number?
They will, I can give it to you.
Good.
After everything
like perfect.
they will ask for citizenship rather than state, and they will ask to participate in the Israeli democracy. Now, I've read the right-wing alternatives, and most of them include a path to citizenship.
Some of them do.
Some of them do. My question is, and there's a question mark, do you sincerely believe that the international community will accept a state in which some people are disenfranchised from voting? And do you believe that if you give Palestinians the opportunity, that they will not take the opportunity to participate in Israeli democracy? Because I've heard a lot from representatives of the settler movement that say we will give them the option to become citizens, but they will not take that option.
You guys are fantastic. You guys are great, really. That was, sometimes I get these people like, blah, they don't know anything. That was a great question, and I much prefer to deal on that level than on like teaching basics. So thank you for that. And I'm going to answer your question in detail and try to do it fast. You asked, first thing, I'm very happy to hear about this young man. I'm happy to hear about this Arab guy, okay? And that's great. And I think that's the way forward. And he's absolutely right. We do have that in common. That is correct, okay? And given that both me and him, we're probably going to win in the end, because the fuddy-duddies that are still saying two-state solution are just trying to keep their jobs, or bureaucrats that are still saying the same thing they did 50 years ago. It's like, you know, they're already leaving the scene, and it's not realistic. You know, you can't really pull out the settlements, and all. It's over, right? So, and politically also in Israel, it's shifted to the right and all that. It's like done. So he's absolutely right. He's cutting edge. He's thinking forward. But let's frame the question more tightly, which is, therefore, what's going to happen is we're going to annex Judea and Samaria, put it under Israeli sovereignty. It's going to be Israel. And then the question is, what do we do with our Arab minority? And I don't mean that in any improper way. I mean to say, what are we going to do? How are we going to handle our Arab minority? And your question in various ways is, do we give them a pathway to citizenship that's real? Will they take the pathway to citizenship? These are all good questions. There is more than one opinion about this matter today. There's about five that I listed. I recently had a New York Times op-ed in February. Look it up. It's called The Settlers' Vision for the Future of Israel. And it basically talks about five alternatives to a two-state solution. Okay? One of them says, the first one says, Jordan is really, these people used to be Jordanian citizens. And Jordan is really the Palestinian state. It's right next door. And it's got 80% Palestinian people. I'm not saying, let's kick out the Palestinians that live here and throw them all to Jordan. No. I'm saying, give them citizenship like they used to have till 1984 of Jordan. Let them vote in Amman, but live here as expats. Meaning that they'll be residents here with resident status and have voting rights in their country. That's opinion number one. Oh, I forgot to say, because of your cute little smile, I have to say the following. Every one of my ideas has a stinky element. Everyone has a crappy, bad element, okay? Every single one of them. And because the situation currently is not so great. And so therefore, I'm going to give you alternatives to at least think about, and we're going to open our minds up a little bit. And yes, there's going to be, you can poke holes in every one of my alternative suggestions, but I can poke holes in two-state solution. So let's now, let's open our minds up. Before I go on to alternative number two, you said something about the international community. Oh my God, the international community, what will they accept? I didn't even know that they like have a say in accepting or not accepting what sovereign countries do.
We give you our money.
You don't give us our money. You give us $3 billion that all goes back to Biden. And by the way, I'd be happy if, and I love America, I respect America, I would love to see it give us $0 and have actual just regular trade. And I don't need the $3 billion. It's a blip on our gross national product. It's absolutely meaningless. It's only so that we could like cement some kind of relationship. I personally absolutely hate it, detest it. And I think that we, so that I never want to hear.
That's what Americans say.
I never want to hear that thing again in my life. That gives money. But I want to say something about the international community. Turkey is occupying Cyprus, right? Nobody says anything. It's been occupying since the 70s. Nobody says anything. America has got 3.5 million Puerto Ricans who don't vote in national elections. Nobody says anything. Nobody gives a damn. A few clicks away from here, 500,000 people have been killed over the last few years. Nobody cares. So I don't think that the international community is going to flip out if we decide to do it one way or another. I think they'll just be like, say whatever they say, and really, who cares? We're a sovereign country. That's just a little point. Option number one I gave, Jordan, is Palestine. You didn't like that a little bit. You gave me a wry smile. Fair enough. I can understand why. Maybe because we can't really force a country to accept other citizenship, or maybe because, you know, if they live here, shouldn't they vote here? Okay. Option number two, Professor Mordechai Kedar says, he's a good friend of mine, he's a professor out of Bar-Ilan, he says, you think there's a Palestinian people? They're really not a people. They're really a very diverse amount of people that are tribal. They are tribal. In fact, Hebron Arabs do not marry Shechem Arabs, Nablus Arabs. They don't marry them. They're just different. They see themselves as a different. They don't want to marry one another. They may wave the same flag today, but they're not really feel themselves as related as you may think. They're much more tribal in a Middle East type of way. Countries is a very European concept. The Middle East hasn't necessarily, and you see that all the European lines are almost broken down. The European lines that have been created here have almost all failed. Only ancient states have basically remained. Egypt, you know, Israel, Iran, you know, the rest have kind of falling apart. They don't have real lines because they're not built that way. They're not thinking that way. So he says, give them self-rule in their areas. There's 7 big major Arab cities. Let them have self-governance. He calls it emirates. Let them have their emirates. It could be either under totally their own sovereignty, or what I would prefer is under Israeli sovereignty, but they would have courts. They would have, governance, governor. They would have their mukhtars. They would have the old system that rules their thing in their Arab areas. The vast majority of Arabs would be ruled in this way, according to Kedar. The sovereignty would be, let's say, my way. Sovereignty would be Israeli, but they would have self-rule. This dovetails very well with what Minister of Education Bennett says. He says, let's just annex Area C. The 400,000 settlers that live in the West Bank, or the Jews that live in Judea and Samaria, live mostly in Area C. Just the next C. Guys, this is a little disturbing. So just the next Area C. So, you know, and that dovetails with Mordechai Kedar. Just the next C. Let A and B be mostly Arab, but let them have self-rule. You know, those are some of the options. I think option number three is probably the most realistic, and this is what you alluded to. No, option number four, excuse me. We did 1, 2, and 3. Option number four is the most realistic. And that's what you spoke about, which is annexation, residency for the Arabs, pathway to citizenship through the oath of loyalty. You see, it's all in hand motions, right? Residency, pathway of citizenship through oath of loyalty. Annexation, residency, citizenship. Now, some people say, give them residency, like in Jerusalem and in the Golan, and let them choose. And you're right, there are some settlers who say they won't want citizenship because they're not really looking for the vote. They don't have democratic, deep democratic roots. They're just looking to live, have rights, have upward mobility. And we're willing to give that. Israel's willing to give Arabs upward mobility. One second. And you're next. Israelis are naturally willing to give Arabs upward mobility in this country. You know, Arabs are in our universities, in our hospitals, in our malls, in our Knesset, and in our Supreme Court. There's no problem with it. We don't have a racial issue with that. Okay, as long as this remains a Jewish state. So in Jerusalem, and in the Golan, we've given them residency. Most of them have not taken up So there's one approach that says give them a pathway to citizenship, and don't worry about it. So there's one approach that says give them citizenship. One approach says give them a pathway to citizenship. And another approach says, no, the Middle East is not a democratic region. Jewish and democratic means this is a democracy for the small Jewish enclave in this region to protect itself. And therefore, for Gentiles, goyim, non-Jews, God bless them. They could live in our country with a Bill of Rights. But the voting is for Jews. That sounds a little harsh. But remember that I gave you the example of America whenever expedient people use it. I have a mashal, a parable of the hitchhiker. Have you guys been hitchhiking in Israel at all? No? Okay. Where I live, I pick up hitchhikers every day. Okay, I pick up hitchhikers all the time. And when I pick up a hitchhiker, I want that hitchhiker to be safe, comfortable, and get to their destination. But if the hitchhiker says to me, can I have the steering wheel? I say, no. Okay? Same thing. I have a minority living amongst me. I want them to be safe, comfortable, get to their destination. I want them to have upward mobility. But I'm still pretty concerned about keeping this a Jewish state. So therefore, I want to treat my residents right, but not give them full carte blanche. If they want self-determination, if they can't swallow it, alam salam, you have 22 Arab countries to choose from. You want to stay with us? Welcome, marhaba, but you have to accept these rules. That's a Middle East attitude, okay? Some people disagree with that. They say, no, give them a real pathway to citizenship, and my liberal friends can swallow that mostly. I have found that the liberal folks that I speak with every day basically say they could swallow this idea, annexation, residency, pathway to citizenship. Your Arab friend basically was saying that.
And demography?
Looks like demography is not what people told us. Looks like our demography is pretty strong. There's alternative demography today. They say that a lot of the Palestinian demography has been overblown. There's a lot of Palestinian exodus. They want to move to America, to Germany, whatever. And we are actually having a lot of babies in our country.
And if you're wrong.
Huh?
And if you're wrong.
Yes, is the risk.
That's a good question. But I, when I speak with people on the left, what they say to me, they give me the whole spiel about how they want to be Jewish and democratic, and therefore they want to what? Pull away the lines of the country so that they don't give democracy to the Arabs. This big liberal idea is gerrymandering. I will move my democracy away so that I don't have to give it because I'm so democratic that I don't want to give it to the Arabs. It's so important to me for I have a Jewish democratic state, but I never want to give it to the Arabs, so I'll just move away from it. Do you understand? I say, as a right-winger, I will have more sovereignty and give more people rights, more people a chance for upward mobility, get rid of the corrupt jihadist Palestinian Authority. Boo. By the way, ask any Arab. I speak with Arabs all the time. I say, who hates Arabs more, Yishai Fleischer or Mahmoud Abbas? Who hates Arabs more? They're like, Mahmoud Abbas. Every time they say it. They detest the guy. True or not? Anybody knows Arabs? You'll ask any Arab. They detest Mahmoud Abbas, unless they're on his payroll. And even then. But I say more people, more rights. Not necessarily full voting rights, but more rights. I'm willing to extend my country and extend its goodness. It's a really good country. Option number 5, I'll finish off with this. That was number 4. Again, 4 split into give them immediate citizenship, give them a pathway to citizenship, or give them no citizenship, but rights. Option number 5 says...
Change of populations.
Yes. Option number 5 is exchange of populations, meaning to say, but not forcible. Okay? Those Arabs who are like, this is not working out, and there are a lot of who are interested in leaving today, Israel will help facilitate their emigration with compensation. Okay, and because we have a conflict that is really not really solvable, it's really, in this option, it's not really something that those two narratives can't coexist. Let's help those people who can't coexist, can't live in Israel, emigrate out. By the way, I have met many Arabs who say to me, the option that you said, because listen, looks like Israel isn't leaving anyway. Like, we'd love to have a Palestinian state, but it doesn't look like Israel's leaving. They have their thing, they have their history, their narrative, they're not leaving anywhere. I think that's totally fair. I think that's fine. Meaning to say, my narrative wins. That's a Middle East way. I'm strong, I'm right, I have my belief, my narrative, I'm going to assert it, and I will be good to the good people, bad to the bad people, and that'll win the day. Those are the 5 options. Yes. Thank you.
So I have
You're very into fairness. Thank you very much.
I'm from San Francisco.
I hear that.
I'm naturally.
I get it. No, it's all good. So I go to San Francisco quite a bit. Yeah.
I have another approach, which is a two-state solution. So let's imagine we have this new state of Palestine occupying the whole West Bank, okay? And you are in Hebron because, as well, you have an ideology that it is our land, it is where our ancestors and our fathers are buried there. Okay, so we come from there. Okay, but what if the Palestinian, this new Palestinian state, is occupying also that city of Hebron? And the solution that they give is rather you become a Palestinian citizen or you leave. So, which is what you are planning as well, like to do to the Palestinians. We give them the right to be citizen. We give them a path, for example. So it's exactly the same to those old Jewish settlers in Hebron.
Sure.
Would you rather go back to Israel or become a Palestinian citizen if that happens?
Okay, good question. You right at the end, you steered a little bit. I just want to kind of take your question at the beginning all the way to the end. Yes, that's a logical and reasonable approach, except that it's just not realistic on the ground, in my opinion, of course.
Of course.
Because the Palestinian Authority has many times said it will never accept any Jews inside. Mahmoud Abbas has said that over and over again. And generally speaking, we left Arab countries under persecution. We don't exactly want to go back to live under Arab control again. We created a Jewish state for exactly this purpose of defense and not to go back into, you know, under other state things. So a person like me is certainly not interested in that. I can understand how that sounds reasonable, but it's not realistic on the ground at all.
Okay, but
given especially also that the Middle East today is moving towards jihadism as a general milieu. So it's just, that's a good thought. It's a pretty thought. It's not real. And we are not in the, that is not what we're about. We're about going back home and asserting our country in what was our historical land. Okay, so I hear it, but I don't think it's real, and I don't want that. But okay, definitely a fair approach. Let's put it this way. If I write the article, that's not what I'm advocating, okay?
Yeah, of course.
Right. Remember, though, by the way, that I'm an advocate not for just fairness or for goodness or for the Palestinians. I'm an advocate for the Jewish people. I work for the Jewish people. I'm concerned with the welfare of the Jewish people. That does not mean I want to trample on other people's rights or be brutal, God forbid. But I am more concerned with the defense and protection and the welfare of my peoplehood as any statesman, any person should be first and foremost.
Anyone would do that.
What's good for you may not be good for the diaspora Jews.
That's a good point, but you'll have
to
wait.
This is not a debate.
No, that's a very interesting question and one that I deal with often. I'd like to answer that, but let's go to this young lady. Yes.
Hi, I'm Alexis, and I'm from Washington, D.C.
What was your name?
Alexis.
Hi, Alexis.
And again, thank you for coming, and it's, I always come in with the optimistic that I'm going to hear something new, and I have, and I really appreciate that. Part of what I do every day is to train high school kids in the U.S. of what they're going to expect when they go onto college campus. And you brought that up earlier in your opening talk about how Jews today are being told and have lost this love for Israel. And I can't disagree with you, and I think that that's one of the biggest threats that we face, is that they see these universalist values as part of their Jewish values, and they get to campus and they want to be environmentalists, they want to be marchers in the pro-LGBTQI movements, they want to be all of these things, and they're told when they get there, you can't do that because you're also a Zionist. And it's really hard because they have to choose, well, do I fight for Black Lives Matter? Do I fight for LGBTQI rights? Do I fight for the environment? Or do I fight for Israel? And their universalist values are winning out because it's more popular and it's easy and nobody likes to feel uncomfortable. So what is your solution for me talking to those kids? How do I tell them and how do I teach them that they can be all of these things and still also love Israel?
Really fabulous question. The first thing I would say is that the commentary that you made is not about those kids, but about the society around them.
This is true.
Right? It's like, why can't I march in LGBT and be pro-Israel? Well, what's wrong with that? Isn't standing up for a small minority of peoples in this world who have been persecuted and are trying to regain rights in their ancestral homeland, isn't that a liberal cause? I'm trying to make a point to you is that, like, you really asked me a question not about the kids but about the world. I would spin that question back to you and say, like, well, what's wrong with campus? What's wrong with the world that you can't be those two things? Like, why can't I? Right? Like, there's something wrong with where they're at. The first thing I would do is send them to a happy campus. I'm serious. I wouldn't send them. No, I tell people all the time.
There's less and less by the day. So
you're absolutely right.
But Daniela, for example, and I'm going to pick on you for a minute and a half, just graduated from the University of Maryland last year. It's a happy campus.
Right. I was going to say Maryland. I was going to say one of the happy campuses.
Huge pro-Israel.
Sure. Been there.
Last year, we had to deal with shop on the sidewalk.
Ooh.
I know, it's horrible, but it's like it's uncomfortable to walk to school to be like, Jews are baby killers. Like, I don't
Absolutely.
Want to see that. That's
first thing, let me applaud the other side. I mean, they're good.
They're real good.
I mean, they're good. And what is their, what defines their real goodness is that they're aggressive. They are like, how should I say? They're like, they're not like,
They're master co-opters.
Right, and they're not, but they're not, can I use the word, can I use the word ninny? Is that a cool word? What is the word I could use? Give me a word.
Listen to me.
Give me a word that I could use to be like lame.
Although that's mean to disabled people. I don't know.
Come on, give me a word. Come on, give me a chance here. Come on. Let's pick a word. Let's use lame.
Absurd.
No, it's not absurd. No. Weak. I'm saying the other side is talking in heat. It's talking in passion. You two stole my land. And we say,
hey, but we invented the cell phone.
You Jews stole the land. Hey, we have gay rights. You Jews stole the land. We go to Haiti to help, like, you know, Haitians after an earthquake. It's so lame, so lame. You know, it's like, I'll tell you a story, okay? It was during the Gaza war, and I got a, it was exactly the Gaza war. I was working at a radio station. I got a phone call from, it says Qatar. On the phone. When it says Qatar, that means who's calling?
Al Jazeera.
Correct. Al Jazeera is calling. And I'm like, hi. They're like, hey, Mr. Fleischer, can you come in, please? They're so nice. Like, can you come in on our show? And I say what I always say to these folks. Yes, I'm willing to come in, absolutely. I love Al Jazeera. But I have to be with only one other person. Because when you're like on a panel, it's like anti-Semite, 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 anti-Semite. Answer, anti-Semite, anti-Semite. It's impossible. It's like, I've been there. I have really, like, don't watch those videos of mine because I'm just like, but when I'm like one on one, then I'm like, you know, I'm hitting back hard, and of course, don't forget the moderator is also anti-Israel, so it's two against one. You know, I can live with that. So I get on Al Jazeera. Oh, so before I get on Al Jazeera, so I have a big friend in the media here in Israel, a great writer. So I said to him, hey buddy, I don't want to use his name. I said, hey buddy, I'm going on Al Jazeera. The war was happening. And he says to me, I said to him, what do you think I should say? He goes, Yishai, you got to talk about our moral army. How moral our army is. We try so hard not to hit schools, kids, and this and that. How we send a missile that's actually empty, it knocks on the roof, and then everybody knows to get out. This is what he says to me. He's like, you have to show them that we actually have a moral army. How's that sound to you guys? Good? I said to him, that is the dumbest thing I ever heard. The minute I am going to start talking about a moral army, there's a video guy behind the thing. He's waiting with the video clip to run as I say, we're the most moral army. We really try hard. They play the clip of the baby being carried out with the hand hanging out, okay? And I look like the biggest Jew liar you ever seen in the world, okay? That's what I look like. We try to say, you're going to come out as a weakling on Al Jazeera. So he's like, okay. I get on Al Jazeera. They're like, Mr. Fleischer, how is it that 70 Israelis have been killed and over 2,000 Palestinians? I'm like, and the video guy's waiting, right? The video guy, he wants me to say, well, we have a moral army, we try so hard, blah, 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 right? He's waiting. So they're like, Mr. Fleischer, how is it that 70 Israelis have been killed and over 2,000 Palestinians? I'm like, that is exactly what will happen to you when you start with us. Don't mess with us. We're a post-Holocaust nation. We're here to defend ourselves. You start with us, you're going to get hammered. Every one of your rockets will get 10 from us. Anybody messes with us, that's exactly what we do. Learn the lesson. Do not mess with this little country. And if you put your children in front of our rockets, they're going to die. That's your fault. All right? Don't start this country. Here's them. They're like, video guy's like, should I put a play it yet? There was a pause. There's a pause. They're just like, okay? Then later on in that same interview, this is all on video, you see it for yourself on YouTube, the same interview, they go back again. They like, they loot, they, what do you call it? What's it called in English?
Reload.
They loop around, they loop back around, right? They're coming back. They want to see if they could hit me again with that. So they're like, but Mr. Fleischer, how could it be that 3,000 rockets, that's what it was, 3,000 rockets have been shot and only, you know, these amount hit anything? How could it be? I'm like, well, I have to take off my journalist hat and put on my rabbi hat right now, okay? And I got to say to you, it's min Allah.
okay? Allah is sweating away the rockets from Israel. There's no other way. What do you think? You think Hamas are stupid? You think they don't know how to aim? It's min Allah.
You said that?
I said it to them. It's on the video. And they're just like, again, the
video. It's on YouTube.
It's on YouTube. Okay? It's on YouTube. And it was just like, but I was talking Al Jazeera language. I was talking Al Jazeera language. I wasn't talking sissy, ninny,
you told them
weak.
Allah was protecting the Jews?
That's what I told them. I said Allah was protecting the Jews. They were like, why not? Why can't I say it? I say that to Arabs all the time. I talk to Arabs all the time. I say to them, how do you think that we beat you in all these wars? Because we're better than you, smarter than you, richer than you, bigger than you. I say, it's min Allah. It says in the Quran 4 times that the Jews are going to come back to the land of Israel. Allah's protecting us. Why don't you submit to the will of Allah?
Yeah.
They're just like, you know, every time. I say to them, you know, because I speak this region. I don't try to give them Western talk. You remember this? Remember they used to teach us, if anybody says it's occupied land, you answer, it's not occupied, it's only disputed. This is what they used to teach Jewish kids, like these weak, ninny answers, lame answers. Be proud, be chazak, get out there. And our country's ambivalence has led, about Judea and Samaria, has led to this weakness and this bad response. For example, I was just at AIPAC, outside, Jewish kids are yelling, end the occupation, and inside, what's his name? The lawyer, Dershowitz, is talking about water technology. They're accusing us of stealing somebody's land, and we're like, we're really good because we have water technology. Didn't you have a question? You had one. Did you? You had one.
It was me.
No, I think he spoke also.
No, I think he asked me a question. No, I want to ask you.
He's been waiting, Andrew.
Go. Sorry, buddy. Yeah, I had to make a choice.
You used me.
You did a great job, though, okay? You came out good. What is that you're drinking? Is that like a South American thing?
Yeah.
You want?
It's
yeah.
Really
good.
I like that. We got it. Yeah, we go. Yeah, no, exactly. Yes, go.
Hi, I'm Andrew from New York.
Hello.
So you might know my boss. His name is Danny Dion. Amongst your contemporaries, I would classify myself personally in this room as a relatively liberal person, but on the Hebron, on the rights of Jews to live in Judea and Samaria, God bless, I'm with you, and I defend that right every day in New York City and the regions in which I cover for Ambassador Dion. But I have to tell you honestly, and I agree with you, that when the Arabs come and they make these statements in Al Jazeera, okay, we should slap them back. They should be slapped. They deserve to be spoken to in their language. But unfortunately, as someone who's dealing with this day to day, on these college campuses, the language that we use here in Israel, okay, on Al Jazeera, and to defend ourselves, does not connect right now with the American public for a myriad of reasons, particularly liberal Jews. And I can sit here and tell you, I wish that wasn't the case, but it's the case. I'm dealing with a woman named Linda Sarsour, you've heard of. Okay, I'm dealing with her. And she's, as you said, she's very, very good. My question is, and I'm trying to articulate this, I know it sounds like a statement, but is there any way in which you can adapt this message, or to be flexible in the message, not in the belief, but in the delivery, in order to get to these liberals, in order to help diffuse some of these situations, because the constant, I won this debate, I won that debate, Israel's right, you're wrong, Israel good, Arab bad,
okay.
Isn't helpful.
Okay, I want to say something to you.
You're driving away the old Jews.
Wait, hold on one second. I am the guy who has debated J Street, and go out to these, debated Shalom Akshav, are constantly on the edge here, and I'm never trying to defeat them. I'm trying to make a conversation. Like, I think it's actually the lame answers that have caused Jews to move away, because when they accuse us of occupation, we don't answer the question. Okay? I deal with liberal groups all the time, and I find that they're like actually quite much more responsive. When they see that you're not actually a racist, that you have make sense in what you're trying to defend, you have to speak it up, but you have to hit the question head on and not be ashamed about it, okay? It's Israel's, it's our beloved country's ambivalence about these things that have caused us to seem like liars. If the Prime Minister of Israel says to the world that he believes in a two-state solution, but he doesn't think it can happen now, then you're just like, people are like, well, what do you mean this? What are we going to do? Or when you tell the Europeans that you want a two-state solution, but you know that it's not going to happen now, and it's been going on for 40 years with endless paperwork but nothing actually on the field, then everybody thinks you're a liar, because you kind of are, because you're not telling the truth. Now, there's two modes in Jewish ways of existence. There's Jacob. Jacob, the way he made it in the Bible, is by sneaking around a little bit. But Israel comes forward to Yisrael, which is Yashar El. You got to be straight. I offer, when I speak, clarity. No BS. You may not like it at the end. You may not like my suggestions, but you're going to come out thinking, A, he gave me a total package. Tap dance, kind of this, kind of that framework. It's a total framework. And you'll understand that it's coming from a reasonable place. That's what I think. More clarity. More assertion of rights. More things that make historical sense. Things that make sense altogether. That will heal the situation. Tell the Europeans the truth. They say to you, average Europeans say to me all the time, you can't have a two-state solution and a settlement policy. I'm like, I agree with you. You're right. I don't want to lie to you.
My issue is that I'm trying, if I try to articulate some of these concepts to an African-American, Hispanic, Asian, other minority audience in the United States right now, particularly on a college campus, these ideas are not, and it's out of Israel's hands. It's just not connecting with them. And
are you sure? If you say,
Of course,
generally we're on the losing side.
I'm not against, right? I'll just be clear. I'm not at all. I'm for Hebron. I'm for.
I got it.
Right?
I got it. Yep, we got it.
Right.
How do we talk to liberal Jews? First thing what's the lady's name again?
Alexis
said, there's another criticism. I got it. We're finishing up. And how much? 1 minute?
Like, yeah.
So 60 seconds. Your question is as much about my message as it also is about where they are. Like in some analysis that you could flip it back, like what's going on with them? They're the ones who are leaving Israel, leaving Judaism. Europe, for example, is post-God, post-family, post-nation, post-nationalism. We, Israel, are not post-God, we're godly. It doesn't matter if you're religious or not. It's a God country, however you spin it. It doesn't matter. That's the way it's perceived. It doesn't matter if it is or it isn't. It's not post-God, it's national, and it's family. And that, for Europeans, for a lot of people in the world, it's a problem. So, you're asking me, how do I squeeze myself into their shoe? I don't know if I can. I'm not sure I can always.
Take one last question. She's been waiting forever.
We're done on time. I'm sorry.
If you have one or two more questions right now, Keisha is willing to stay. But, we just need to start getting on the bus. So, basically, I want to let people go so that they can go to the bathroom, et cetera, get ready to get on the bus. So if you want to stay and ask one more question, that's fine.
Let me make one last sentence, though.
Yeah,
sentence. One last sentence is, if you guys want, always willing to come back and speak some more. I think you guys are fabulous. I mean that. I'm not just saying that. I think you guys are really thinking about these things very seriously. I think there are solutions. I think there is hope. There is future. I'm very excited about Israel. I'm excited for the future of Arabs as well. I'm excited for what this country is doing. This is the best country in the region. It's going to be a light into this region. There's going to be a good future, okay? Let's keep positive. Stay in touch with me, Yishai Fleischer. I'm on both Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, SoundCloud, iTunes, YouTube. If you can't find me, then there's something wrong with you, okay?
I want to thank Yishai so much for speaking with us. Thank you.